This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There have been major budget cuts hitting the East Africa aid sector hard. This is hitting hard in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania, where many aid agencies, including Norwegian Refugee Council, we've had to close some of our refugee programs in refugee camps.
That's Gino Tiafolo, Regional Head of Communications for East Africa and Yemen of the Norwegian Refugee Council. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, representatives of South Sudan's warring parties and civil society groups are expected to sign a final peace deal today. Eritrea returns to the eight-country IGAD trade bloc as it continues to improve relations with its neighbors, and violence continues to disrupt life in many parts of Cameroon. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. IGAD heads of state and government are meeting in Ethiopia's capital to deliberate finalizing a deal to resolve South Sudan's conflict. Activists have urged the warring parties to compromise on major unresolved issues to end the nearly five-year-old conflict, such as the numbers of states and defining their boundaries. It is not clear if the agreement will be finalized and signed tonight. President Salva Kiir arrived in Addis Ababa to join other heads of state from Ethiopia, Djibouti, Eritrea, Somalia, Sudan, Uganda, and Kenya for IGAD's annual assembly. They also are expected to discuss the normalization of relationships between Djibouti, Eritrea, and Sudan. Eritrea has returned to the eight-country IGAD trade bloc as it continues to improve relations with its neighbors and ease its isolation. The moves have eased concerns about conflict spreading across the Horn of Africa. Well, people are deserting the English-speaking regions of Cameroon after hundreds of armed separatists and the military were involved in clashes yesterday in five towns and villages that left at least 15 people dead. Local residents complained that the army was slow in responding to simultaneous attacks by the separatists. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Buea in southeastern Cameroon.
Intensive shooting between an unknown number of armed separatists and at least 50 soldiers of the Rapid Intervention Battalion B, an elite corps of Cameroon's military, is going on at Mile 16, Bolifamba, a neighborhood in the southwestern town of Buea. As the military shoots, some of the troops clear the wreckage of vehicles, abandoned containers, trees and heavy metals the armed separatists are said to have used in blocking all entrances into the town before the military arrived. The military said the attackers also burned vehicles, houses and shops. Some residents are rushing to various destinations, including the bush. 24-year-old businessman Peter Bonkiyung says he saw two corpses, including that of a soldier, and does no longer feel safe in the town.
I'm still believing that, come on, whatever, I have to go.
Janine Ita, a 47-year-old jurist working in the town, is also living with her three children and wounded husband. She says the armed men invaded Mile 16 as early as 5 a.m. Tuesday, blocking the road and setting some transport buses on fire. Janine says she is surprised that the military, which is found at various entrances to the town, came late.
We cannot continue living in such an environment where you cannot even trust your neighbor. Where are the armed men coming from? How do they get into town without the knowledge of the military?
Similar simultaneous attacks were reported in four other villages in the northwest and southwest regions, including Bamenda, Mamfe, and Wum. Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of the Southwest region, says he is pleading with the separatists to drop their guns and stop the carnage. He says the upcoming presidential election should offer an opportunity for them to democratically express their views should they be disgruntled with the government.
The presidential election is a very important moment for all the country in the world, and the Southwest should not miss to be fully involved in the presidential election, the 7th of October. We should stop the killings, the kidnapping, the disturbances, and all the nuisance that the present crisis has brought in our region.
The government has been assuring voters that they will be protected. Unrest began in Cameroon in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers demonstrated against the overbearing use of the French language. Separatists took over and started demanding the independence of the English-speaking from the French-speaking regions of the bilingual country. Last Saturday, armed Anglophone separatists burned buses and blocked traffic into and out of the capital of the English-speaking Northwest region and said the action in Bamenda was to disrupt next month's presidential election. The United Nations reports that 300 people, including 130 policemen and the military, have been killed. Hundreds of thousands have fled for their lives to the bushes and towns in the French-speaking regions. At least 20,000 have crossed over to Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Boya, Southwestern Cameroon.
The United Nations says the cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe is a very dire situation because there are now cases outside the country's capital where the government has declared a state of emergency. Columbus Mavhunga reports for VOA from Harare.
Zimbabwe's health minister Obadiah Moyo is calling on international agencies to chip in following 20 deaths and more than 2,000 cases related to waterborne diseases such as Salmonella, typhoid, and cholera. Sirak Gebrehiot, the United Nations spokesperson in Zimbabwe, says UN agencies have since moved in to try and stabilize the situation.
This cholera situation is very dire situation. The hotspot is Harare district, but we are getting reports of cases, confirmed and unconfirmed, in other parts of the country, like Shamva, Mashingo, and Buhera districts. We are providing all the support we could, intervention, positioning and repositioning the essential medications. But at the same time, the issue is on strengthening the surveillance system.
Health Minister Moyo on Tuesday said his government wants to address the issue of poor water supply, blocked sewers, and irregular trash collection, the factors he said were making a cholera outbreak in the capital worse. Dr. Norman Matara of Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights said his organization has since volunteered resources to avoid unnecessary deaths from the cholera outbreak. But he said the group wants President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government to quickly improve the water treatment system.
Cholera is a disease which is quite ancient, easily presentable, so we just have to provide safe drinking water, have proper sanitation facilities, and then we won't have cholera. But we've been seeing all year around broken down sewers all over the places, even the piped water, you would see dirty water coming out of the tap, and we were breathing cholera all along. We knew we were sitting on a time bomb. Soon we were going to have cholera, but nothing was done.
Officials are trying to fix broken sewer pipes in Budiriro, one of the most affected parts in Harare. A 2008 cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe lasted for more than a year and killed about 5,000 people. It only stopped after international groups like United Nations agencies and USAID donated drugs and water treatment chemicals. Columbus Mavhunga for VOA News, Harare.
A refugee and migrant catastrophe looms over the East African countries accepting them as Western governments reduce funding, causing aid programs to shut down. The Norwegian Refugee Council says life-saving programs in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania are critically underfunded this year, which is creating deteriorating conditions in many refugee camps. Migrants are facing shortages of food, clean water, and other vital services. Gino Teofilo is the regional head of communications for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Nairobi. He spoke with me about the dire situation of the refugees and migrants in East Africa.
There have been major budget cuts hitting the East Africa aid sector hard. This is hitting hard in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania, where many aid agencies, including Norwegian Refugee Council, we've had to close some of our refugee programs in refugee camps. We're very worried because without more funding, malnutrition is set to rise, waterborne diseases can break out, and schools for refugee children can close.
Why is the funding falling so short?
Well, the funding from Western governments and from the rich countries, including the United States, they've dropped significantly. In Kenya this year, for example, the overall UN funding appeal, which partly funds us, received only $97 million this year. That's down from $340 million the year before. There also were similar drastic cuts in Uganda and in Tanzania. So this has resulted in drastic cuts to life-saving programs for refugees living in the camps, for programs such as water and sanitation and shelter and other necessary programs that are needed for their survival.
And approximately just how many people are we talking about who will be affected?
With current funding, our agency will be able to help about 149,000 fewer refugees this year for Kenya alone. And that's just in Kenya. In Uganda, for example, we've had to reduce our programs for shelter and for water and sanitation for several thousands of refugees. And this is very worrying because when there's less clean water and sanitation, the risks rise for waterborne diseases like cholera. So we don't have cholera right now, but that is a risk that we want to avoid.
Your organization mentions there's a window of opportunity to avoid a refugee catastrophe. What is that window of opportunity?
We only have weeks, really, to start getting some of these programs up and running again. We are starting to hit a gap where we've had some programs have to close down. Other programs are going on, and we are trying to spread out our resources as best we can. And it's not just us. It's other aid agencies, including United Nations agencies. We're doing great work to help people survive. But as the resources shrink, as the funding drops, then there's less food for people. So malnutrition is a threat. There's less clean water. And we do what we can, but without the resources to help these people, the threats of increased fatalities and increased disease outbreaks certainly rises.
That was Gino Teofilo, Regional Head of Communications for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Nairobi. Eighteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The World Health Organization says experience with Ebola outbreaks has yielded new tools against the deadly virus that allow health workers to give hope to patients and their families. But the frequency of the outbreaks is worrying for the future, with external factors ranging from increased urbanization to climate change playing a role in Ebola and other pathogens. This is the second part of my colleague Paul Alexander's interview with Peter Salama, the World Health Organization's Deputy Director General in charge of emergencies.
What we're seeing is certainly a paradigm shift in the way we are confronting Ebola outbreaks. In the past, we had very little to offer communities other than to isolate sick people and to give information to communities and to discuss hygiene and hand washing, and of course to trace very carefully the contacts. Now we have a much more optimistic message that I think is giving people a lot of hope, which is to say that we can protect your family members, your carers, your healthcare workers, your neighbors with vaccines so that they don't have to become infected. And also, if you do, if you are unfortunate enough to contract Ebola, you have got the option of coming to an Ebola treatment unit and getting more than just rehydration and supportive treatment, but actually the kind of sophisticated medications that you would benefit from in a Western country.
So how difficult is this education campaign?
Well, it's always difficult with a disease such as Ebola because it's so frightening. I mean, it really is a terrifying disease. And so people naturally panic. And that level of fear is always hard to counter. I would say, though, in terms of the big picture for this outbreak response, the level of community acceptance has been extremely high. We tend to focus on, you know, those isolated cases of refusal or reluctance or resistance. But actually, when you look at the big picture here, in almost all, apart from three or four of the 48 rings for ring vaccination, 100% of people who are eligible for vaccination actually agreed to be vaccinated. And I think that's extremely important because it really is saying that even in a population that didn't know anything, and they really didn't, even the healthcare workers, about Ebola prior to this outbreak, you can quite quickly help people understand both the significance of the disease, but also what options they have to protect themselves. Radio has been critical in this community, and our radio messages on Ebola are reaching more than 2 million people now.
Has there been any linkage found between these two recent outbreaks, and are you concerned at all that this could be the start of any sort of pattern?
So we've determined through genetic laboratory testing that this is the same species of Ebola, the same strain, Ebola Zaire, but the type is very different, the subtype. So this is a different outbreak from a genetic and epidemiological point of view. There hasn't been any overlap between the cases in Bandaka and the west of the country and this outbreak. So they're two distinct outbreaks. At the same time, we've had three outbreaks of Ebola now in DRC in just over a year. And this is part of a broader pattern that we're seeing with a range of what we call these high-threat pathogens, these diseases that really have a very high mortality rate, causing a lot of death. And it's a pattern that is quite concerning. And we believe what's behind the increased frequency of some of these disease outbreaks is a combination of climate change, population growth, population encroachment on traditional animal kingdoms such as the equatorial forest in DRC, for example, and, of course, population mobility, people really being on the move and traveling, as well as urbanization. And because of all of those factors, we're starting to see a real trend of outbreaks of high-threat pathogens in urban or peri-urban areas. And that's particularly concerning for us, because these diseases are very different if they're occurring in remote, rural, isolated communities as opposed to occurring in highly populated parts of the world, as we're seeing now in these towns of Benin, Anguina, or Butembo particularly. And what that means is that one case, rather than having one or two secondary cases associated with it, might have many more in the context of a denser population. And that makes it much harder to control. In fact, it almost acts like a different disease in urban areas.
That was WHO official Peter Salama speaking with my colleague, Paul Alexander. Several African heads of state are expected to pay their respects at tomorrow's funeral for former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. Annan's body has been lying in state at the Accra International Conference Center since arriving from Switzerland, where he died at the age of 80 last week. A steady stream of mourners have filed through to see him, and was born and raised in Ghana. He joined the UN in 1962 and rose through the ranks to become the first black African to lead the organization, serving as Secretary General from 1997 to 2006. Well, Italian Foreign Minister Enzo Milanzi held talks with Libyan military strongman Khalifa Haftar and briefed rival Fayez al-Sarraj, prime minister of the UN-backed Government of National Accord in Tripoli. Sarraj said conditions for planned elections this year are not yet ripe. Malanzi said while Italy is a key supporter of the al-Sarraj government, it wants to maintain active dialogue with all well-intentioned players in Libya. Jason Pack, founder and president of Libya Analysis, explained to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi the significance of the Italian move and France's backing of General Haftar.
This is a very interesting move, as traditionally the Italians have had more influence in the west of Libya. The things they care about, where migrants flow to Italy, is from western Libya, and all of their oil infrastructure controlled by Eni culminates in the Zawiya terminal, which is in the west. So maybe as Tripoli has descended into a second civil war, they want to make sure that the French don't outflank them as the dominant actor in Libya. So it makes sense for them to try to cultivate a broader alliance of connections. Another analysis is that to be able to control Tripoli, any actor is going to need to cut a deal with Haftar. So he is now the man looming over everything in Libya, and the Italians are acknowledging that reality.
Italian foreign minister said also that the current political path must be completed, in particular through free and fair elections held under adequate security conditions. General Haftar said he was ready to contribute to actively support security, stabilization, and dialogue in the country for the good of all Libyans, as he said. Would Haftar use this to consolidate his power?
That's a very appropriate question. Of course, all of the actors who promised to support the elections are only doing so as a gambit to increase their power. However, Haftar and his supporters are the largest single bloc in the country, and they need to be not only allowed to participate, but they need to be brought in to help secure the elections. They can't happen without them. I don't believe elections are going to happen, though. And what's interesting is that the rhetoric of the elections are backed primarily by France. And this is an example of the Italians admitting that that's where the debate on the international political level is. It's who can dominate the Libya file and manipulate the happening of the elections in the way that most benefits them. So both Haftar and the Italians and the French and many others are competing to set the narrative around the elections.
Sarraj's government of national accord has been unable to form a functional army or regular security forces and has been forced to rely on militias to keep Tripoli safe. However, the Libyan capital has been lately at the center of a battle of influence between armed groups, including some affiliated with General Haftar. Could that influence the outcome of the planned elections?
Well, what's happened in the last 3 weeks is no more and no less than the start of a second Libyan civil war. The first civil war came about in 2014 when the losers of the 2014 HOR election, Islamists and Misratins and others, wanted to contest the electoral results by kicking the Zintanis out of the airport. And that sparked a fight for the control of Tripoli. Now a similar fight has broken out because the five actors who control Tripoli, the cartel of militias, they have been monopolizing all the smuggling opportunities. And in an attempt to kick them out, this new civil war has started. What is the proximal cause is that fear that any elections would shake up who's in power. If you're a militia and you can get access to subsidized petrol, or you can get letters of credit and buy money at the cheaper official rate and sell it at the more expensive black market rate, so whoever has access to those choke points will use them to gain wealth. And those who were cut out, like the Tarhuni militias and others and Haftar, they want to fight to change the balance of power. And unfortunately, I don't think elections are going to be a way to resolve this. You need a broader economic deal where there are no winners and losers and everyone is able to participate and there's less incentive for corruption. Only then can it make sense to talk about elections.
That was Jason Pack, founder and president of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion with Ugandan pop star Bobby Wine on his arrest, detention and release, and why he came to the U.S. to seek medical attention. Ugandan politics in the spotlight on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.